Okay, good evening. We start tonight what I would describe as being a slightly different focus in terms of the Achronim. I think you can sort of group various Achronim together, so sort of Nadav Yehuda, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, Chatam Sofer, all came from a shared sort of background with shared sort of concerns. And we're now shifting to somebody who came really 100 years later and was confronting, as I said at the end of last week's share, a very different set of concerns and halachic worries. This is Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, the author of the Melames and Lahoel, and he formed part of a caucus of German rabbonim who lived in the second half of the 19th century, and as you can see from the dates at the top of the page, even into the first part of the 20th century. And they were dealing with a very different religious reality, social reality, and halachic reality. So Rav David Zvi Hoffman is sort of a contemporary of Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer. He was actually a Talmud of Rabbi Azriel, Rav Selig Baling, Seligman Bear, Bamberger, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. They all sort of come together in a sort of group who were very much, on the one hand, fighting reform. Reform by the middle of the 19th century was now very strong, and in Germany was preeminent. Orthodoxy had been reduced to a small proportion of the Jewish community. That's one consideration. And also just the way that the Jewish community in Germany had found itself, for want of a better word, emancipated, or one might say educated. It was a very different type of Jewish community than it was in Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe, whether they were living in the cities or the villages, they were living in the shtetl, and they were trying to live in the shtetl. In Western Europe, it was very different. They were a university-educated Jewish community. They had adopted Western lifestyle, Western ideas, etc. And the big challenge was to create what Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch very famously champions, the notion of Torah im Derech Eretz, to combine traditional Judaism with an involvement in society, or if not an involvement in society, at least an involvement in the ideas that were going round in society, the notion of a general education, etc., etc. Rav David Zvi Hoffman himself, he comes from a slightly interesting pedigree in the sense that he was a Talmud of the Maharam Shik. Maharam Shik, in turn, was a Talmud of the Chatam Sofer, who we saw in the first week of the series of Shiurim. So he comes very much from that halachic tradition on the one hand. On the other hand, I think it would be a broader outlook on life than perhaps the Chatam Sofer and the Maharam Shik would have had. He, in due course, became himself the what they called the rector of the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin. The Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin was an attempt at fusing secular studies with Jewish studies and producing a well-rounded Jew. German poskim of the time and the German religious leaders divided into two camps. There were those who were the separatists, which Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch was one of those who believed in setting up their own religious communities and disassociating themselves from the wider Jewish community. And there were those who said, so long as we can have autonomy on our own religious issues, then we still want to be part of that wider Jewish community. And of course, we can see reflections of those sorts of discussions and debates, you know, even in contemporary contemporary Anglo-Jewish scene today, 150, 200 years on. And those issues which haven't yet been solved. We could have a series of five or six shiurim on the Shaylos and Tshuvot of Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, as we could have done on the Nadav Yehuda and the Chatam Sofer as well. But he's got, you know, very, very fascinating issues that he deals with. I did have a list of things that I must have left in the car. Always good when you find a fiver instead of the notes that you were looking for. At least you've gained in some way. I think in terms of his gadlus in Harar, he certainly wasn't as brave and as original a thinker as the Nozav Yehuda, the Chacham Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. We'll see very much that, you know, he's repeatedly quoting and citing earlier authorities. Nevertheless, he was a master of the sources that he had, and he referred very much, you know, to the psakim of earlier rabbonim, rather than creating his own mahalach through a sugya. It's also worth noting that some people would say that Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, he wasn't really a halachist, he was really a biblical scholar. And probably the likes of Ben Elton could write us or give us a lecture on the different schools of biblical study at the time. And certainly Rav David Tzvi Hoffman played a large role in defending the validity of the Torah from an orthodox perspective. Anyhow, that's the background information. Let's start on the notice I put out, the Facebook notice on the about the share. I said, come and listen to what Rav David Tzvi Hoffman thought about organs in shuls. And that's one of the tshuvot I actually haven't got in front of us. But it's certainly, I haven't got it in front of us because it's a lengthy teshuva. But I think it's typical of really the issues that he was dealing with. The issue of the organ was an issue that came up about 200 years ago, and that was part of the initial reforms that were going on in the synagogue, particularly in Hamburg and in other places across Germany, that organs were being brought into shuls. And he addresses the question whether or not you can have an organ playing in shul. Goes without saying that you can't have it playing on Shabbat, and that's been dealt with, he says, by in the 1820s, something like that, 1815, 16, something like that. There was a lot written about the question of an organ. So, you know, some communities wanted to have an organ playing on Shabbat with a non-Jew at the keyboard, and that sort of thing. That was prohibited by the Rabbonim of the time. He's addressing the question whether you can have it at weekday services. That would go down really well in LHC on 7 o'clock Shacharit on a Wednesday morning. You know, accompanied by an organ, but also the question of weddings. And such things, and and he addresses it from a number of halachic perspectives. He gives us a review in his tshuva of the halachic thinking to date and what's been said about it. Makes an interesting observation that the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin included it as part of the Ketav HaSmicha. You also got a letter telling you that you weren't allowed to be the rabbi of a shul which has an organ playing in there, certainly not on Shabbat. And then he goes on to discuss the whole background to organs in shul, question as to, you know, the music in the Beit HaMikdash and why music wasn't chosen to be in shuls. Chazal were never mataking the notion that there should be an organ or music playing in synagogue services, even though there was in the temple service. He discusses the question of chukat hagoy and to whether or not we can say, and the whole question of something which is not necessarily a non-Jewish practice per se, but which has become adopted by the Gentiles, whether that can take on the status of being a chukat hagoy. And he addresses those questions quite comprehensively. But then, very importantly, he introduces a new halachic concept towards the end of his tshuva. He introduces a concept of chukata apikorsim. As he said, chukata goy, you know what? It might not fall into the categories of chukata goy, but it might well fall into the category of chukata apikorsim. Now, chukata apikorsim doesn't exist anywhere in Talmud or Shulchan Aruch, but it's a term that he's coining, and what he's referring to is the notion that this is one of the things which is characteristic of the reformers, and therefore, because the reformers are doing it, we have an obligation not to do it. Because it's what he calls the thin end of the wedge, but once we start saying, Imamish says the thin end of the wedge, not in those lasha, Imamish says it in different words, but the point is it's a slippery slope. It says you say yes to this, and they're going to be, that they're going to be on tenterhooks for you to say yes to all of their other ideas. And that's what they're going to expect from you. And therefore, it's against the din to have an organ in shul at any time. Again, it's like kind of interesting too, 150 years on. So I wouldn't say organs are commonplace in Orthodox synagogues, and they're not. But certainly at weddings, in Orthodox shuls, you'll have not necessarily a church organ, but a keyboard playing while the chatan and kala come in. We've all been at weddings like that under the auspices of the chief rabbinate, and nobody bats an eyelid. So it's like kind of interesting things which cause everybody to gasp out loud. At one stage, 150 years on, when the issues have become perhaps less sharply defined, so then nobody really worries too much about it. In terms of whether we have an organ or a keyboard playing at a chuppah now or not, is not going to make any difference to the battles between reform and orthodoxy. Once upon a time, that was going to be the battleground. And I suppose, and I want to be very cautious what I say, and one's always nervous when one's recording a shiur that this will be taken out of context or put all over the internet before one knows about it. But I suppose, in terms of if a contemporary poseik, Rav Vosner in Bnei Brak, that's were to write a tshuva about organs nowadays in shuls, it would be almost irrelevant to the Orthodox world because we've gone past that issue, and the Reform world wouldn't be interested in what he's saying at all. It's got no relevance. I suppose it was the equivalent of today's debate about partnership minyanim. That's that sort of thing, which is a debate in the Orthodox world and touches on the issues of orthodoxy, non-orthodoxy, shifting away from orthodoxy, all those sorts of things. And that would be, I suppose, the parallel historical context. Okay, let's learn some Torah. And more introduction before we learn the Torah. But one thing I've pointed out is that in previous Shuvot we've had sort of the mix of the old and the new. I would say the bulk of the issues that the Melamed Lahoil addresses tend to be more of the new issues. He doesn't really thrash out the old issues again. A few tshuvot of that nature, but as we can see, I've brought I think nine tshuvot here, which I think were pertinent at the time and have still got a relevance in one way or another nowadays as well. So is the first question I want us to address the question: can you have a minyan of only eight people? Now, Baruch Hashem in Al Eitz Zion, we never have that problem. But I was, the rabbi in a shul which always struggled for a minyan for a couple of years. Sometimes you'd be lucky if on a Friday night you've got eight people. So, oh, this is perhaps a good question. This was presumably some sort of community where Tefillah B'Tzibur wasn't as strong as it needed to be. And he makes an interesting description at the beginning of what was going on there. Ma shekatavsha shekatavsha shebikilatacha yesh minhag kavua. So in your community, that's a place called Yamanich, there's a minhag from the days when Reb David Oppenheim, I don't know who he was, but he sounds like he was presumably the an important Rav there. If necessary, even if you only got eight people in shul, you can have a full tefillah, kasarat hashatz, kriyat haTorah, etc. Lo ra'iti shum smach leminhag zeh. I've searched high and low. I can't find any basis for it whatsoever. Uvilti safeku minhag b'taut. And I can tell you without a doubt, this is a mistaken minhag. Nikba al yidei borim. That's ignorant people introduced it. V'taluit atzman b'ilan gadol b'harav Reb David Oppenheim. And you know what they said? Oh, well, you know, Reb David Oppenheim, he allowed it in his time. I don't believe he agreed with it. That's don't believe it's true. And if I find out that that is what was going on, doesn't mean to say in any sense that he agreed with it. He couldn't do anything about it. So leave them be rather than make a fuss about it. So this is just kind of interesting, just in terms of practical rabbinic hora'ah, if you like. I've often, had people say to me, "Oh, you know, Rabbi so and so used to permit such and such a thing." And if it sounds too good or too wild to be true, usually it is too wild to be true. And you make some inquiries afterwards, and it wasn't him; it was somebody else, and it wasn't quite what they're saying was permitted. That's somebody once told me, Diane so and so says that at a shiva house, the men and the women can all stand together for davening. I didn't believe that he'd said it, and I made some inquiries. He hadn't said anything at all. It was a different Diane who'd said that at a shiva house, if the men stand at the front and the women stand at the back for davening, then that's all right. But that's very different to what was reported to me. So this is what he's saying here as well. I don't believe he allowed it, and even if he did allow it, it wasn't because he allowed it. He allowed it because he couldn't do anything about it. Then he goes on to say, where might there be some basis for this? And he says, so there's a sugya in Masechet Sofrim, which says, Rabotin Shebamarav Omrim B'Shiva, that the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael say that you can say Devarim Shebikdusha with seven people there. So he goes on to say that, first of all, if you learn through that sugya properly, it's not clear at all that it's talking about doing a full tefillah. It might only be talking about saying Kaddish and Baruch Hu. That's number one. Number two, the way that some people learn the sugya, and this is the way the Tosfot in Masechet Megillah learn it, is it's talking about, no, you need seven people perhaps who haven't yet davened to be able to have tefillah at Sibur. And then he goes on to say that in any event, nobody accepted the ruling in Masechet Sofrim. And he says, in any event, if they were relying on the ruling in Masechet Sofrim, so then where would you get this notion of eight from? It would be seven that you need. And therefore, that's a proof that there's no truth to it at all. And then in the final paragraph, he says, you know what you need to do? You need to have a minion rota. And you need to get people on board and to make sure that they will come regularly and support the daily minyan. But I brought this because any rabbi who's been rabbi of a community outside of Northwest London has at times faced this challenge of being short, perhaps sometimes regularly, for a minyan. The second shuva I've got is very fascinating. It's fascinating from two perspectives. One is the question. I mean, what was going on here is that you had Jewish boys who were going to school on Saturday morning. They couldn't get time off school, and they wanted to. They were from, so they were coming back to shul on Shabbat afternoon. Nowadays, I think one or two of the public schools still have a sport or whatever on Saturday mornings. I think if any Jewish boys go, they certainly don't come to shul for mincha and the shir on Shabbat afternoon. That's not why they were going to those schools. So he's dealing with this question. Boys were going to school Shabbat, that was prevalent, but they were also coming to shul Shabbat afternoon. So could they make up the laning on Shabbat afternoon? It's also interesting who this tshuva is addressed to. This tshuva is addressed to the late Rabbi Duna of the Adas in London, Rav Yosef Tzvi Duna. He wasn't at the time of Rav in England. He was Rav at the time still in Germany. He was a Talmud of the... he was a Talmud of the Sri Daesh and others, and I think this tshuva was originally addressed to him. Though now, as I say it, I have a feeling maybe there was a similar tshuva of the Sri Daesh which was addressed to him. So I put that point on hold. In any event, that's his question. So can they come Shabbat afternoon, have leining and leining musaf, and then daven mincha? That's So let's see what he says. Bikala Dutch Israel Berlin. So this is what happened, he said, in Berlin. Nitkanal Pimo Reinu Haraf Rebbe Israel Hildesheimer Zatzal. This was from the days of Rebbe Israel Hildesheimer. Sheba'at Hanarim She'en Yecholin La'lo Veitek Knesset Lifnei Atzaharayim. For the boys who can't come to Shul Shabbat morning. Torin Achar Atzaharayim Beit Gimul Sha'ot Kol Asidra. Then 2 or 3 hours after in the afternoon, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you lay in the whole laning. The Korin Zion Gavre, call up 7 people, Bo'amrin Haftarayim Habrachot, and say the Haftarah. Yachar Kach Mitpalin Musaf Ad Gemira. Then you daven the whole of Musaf, right till the end. Yachar Kach Mitpalin Minchim Kriyat Gimul Gavre. Then you have Mincha, call up 3 people. Vafal Pishi Yishlefak Pekal Zen, even though one can raise one's eyebrows about it. That Rebbe Azriel has already ruled that it's all right, and therefore that's what goes on. Now, what are the issues? The Katab Dagul Mervafa. So he's referring to Dagul Mervafa is the Nod Abihuda. Nod Abihuda is the, what he calls his Shelot and Shivot. The Dagul Mervafa is what he called his commentary on Shulchan Aruch. The Imbatlu Shachrit HaKriya. He says, you know, if you miss Leining and Mincha, that's Shulchan Aruch talks about, you know, the case where there was a big row in Shul on Shabbat morning, and they never got to the Leining, right? And there was no Leining Shabbat morning. Over Mincha Matzu Menucha, and by Shabbat afternoon, tempers had calmed down. That's Im Yesh Panay Likrot Kol Asidra. So if you've got the time to lane the whole Sedra, Yikru Uba Mincha Kol Asidra, then lane the whole Sedra at Mincha, Yikru Shiva Gavre, and you call up 7 people, Ki Kol Yom HaShabbatus Manak Kriya, because it's not just the Kriya Fatah is not limited to the morning on Shabbat, it goes throughout the entire day. The Chatav Azev Sefer Mishnah Brura, so he's quoting the Mishnah Brura, which in his day would have been fresh off the press, you know, that the page is still still crisp. That's I'm not sure exactly what date this tshuva was written. The Mishnah Berurah was finished round about the year 1900, something like that. But you know, it was a new sefer. He's still quoting Mishnah Berurah. The Ikrua Seder Shel Shachrit Kodem Atchalat HaMincha. First lane the Sedra and then lane the Davon Mincha. Yachar Kach Yomru Ashrei V'Letzion V'Achar Kach Yikru Kriya Shel Mincha Kenahog. Then do Ashrei V'Letzion Mincha, etc. V'nei Zehu, now here's his point. V'nei Hu Zeh Rakim Pam Achat Batlu Machmat Ones. You can only do this, okay, if once in a while, you know, this is what happens. Once, you know, once in a yovel, there's a row in shul and they don't get through to the lady. But you can't, that's, I know we've just set up a 9:15 minion on Sunday mornings in Al Etzion, but we can hardly say, you know what, we're closing down, that's the main minion, and we're just having, you know, that's Mincha Gedola, 12:30, we'll have Kriyat Atarah for Shachrit Musaf, and then do Mincha as well. You can't do that. Omnam, Kedei Shelo Tishtakach Torah Kriyat Sefer Torah Min Hanarim Hanitzrachim Lalechet Levatei Gymnasium. But so that the boys who have to go to the state schools, basically, won't lose the concept of Kriyat HaTorah, well, the Shabbat say Sefer B'Shabbat Kodesh and various schools on Shabbat, Tiknu B'Dochak Lachsot came B'Chol Shabbat. They said you can do this every Shabbat. The Gamit Palin Musaf in Minyan, Davin Musaf with the Minyan, V'Vadayim Tzla Omek HaDin Ein La'amod B'Dinim Tikkun Zeh, Achit Lachsot Lashem Heferu Torah Techa. It's not right, but what can we do? It's a fascinating tshuva here, because what he's clearly grappling with is a community which is in orthodox disarray, and he's realizing that, you know, if we take a strict approach about it, then there's just going to be a whole generation of teenagers who, there's no Kriyat HaTorah for them, there's no davening Musaf. Whether they'll come back Shabbat afternoon, won't come back Shabbat afternoon, that's who knows. But he sees the eight lasot Lashem heferu taratecha. He sees this is shat hadachak, and you've got to take a lenient approach in order to save orthodoxy in that way. So that's a very fascinating fascinating tshuva there.
Any kind of background from Haredi or more right wing people who thought he was maybe.
I'm not sure the world was sort of divided itself quite in that way at the time. I don't think in any sense he was regarded as being. I'm not sure the term Haredi had been coined yet. I don't think he was regarded as anything less than being, totally orthodox. The issues were, he was regarded by the Eastern European Rabbonim was suspicious of the German Rabbonim, but that was largely to do with secular education and those things. In terms of their halakhic approach, that didn't come up. The issues were also, how do you do you say like the Chatam Sofer Chadash Asa Min HaTorah? Don't make any concessions whatsoever. Because that's just opening the door to reform, or do you take a something of a compromise position, which he's taking in that tshuva, in order to strengthen orthodoxy? And that's clearly the point. We shouldn't think in any sense that Rabbi David Tzvi Hoffman was in any he was trying to introduce reform. He spent his life. Fighting against reform, and the question was, as it is today, right? What is the best way of preserving orthodoxy, and that's how the Orthodox Jewish world divides itself now. Do you say all shuls can only have Shomrei Shabbat as members because that's the best way of keeping orthodoxy intact, or do we say no, even people who aren't Shomrei Shabbat can be our members? Because we've got to keep them within the fold of orthodoxy, and that's that was exactly the question in Germany, and it's the same question here today. Yes.
In the first paragraph, you ended up. Is he still continuing with that same question, or did something?
No, it's exactly the same question. Well, he's saying Kfar Azaken is he was a Talmud of Reb Ezrael Hildesheimer. So he's saying, how can I? I can't argue against Reb Ezrael. It seems strange to me. He goes on to explain why it seems strange, but he's endorsing the practice. I guess a generation on, and this was a question. Can it still be? Can it still be maintained? I brought question three, which we actually won't look at inside. But it's an interesting question here. This is talking about Königsberg, which, if I'm not mistaken, was where Königsberg was. I think where Rav Jacobowitz's father was the dayan, and also I think that also Rabbi Dunner was a rav in Königsberg before the war. And this is reflecting the notion of the complex communal system that developed in Germany in the 19th century, and without going into all the historical details, and Ben Elton wrote some article which referred to a lot of this in Degel a couple of years ago, but certainly you've got the large community which was responsible for everybody. This was government government demanded that there should be an organized community, and then there was a question: the government gave rashut for the Orthodox to be successionists if they if they wanted to be. And you've got here the question that I suppose it's a little bit similar to, the Board of Deputies. The Board of Deputies is not an orthodox body. It's an umbrella group, at least in theory, for, all parts of the community. So here he's got the discussion. They want to sell a shul. They go through the question, under what circumstances can you sell a shul? They're going to sell the shul to the main Gemeinde, to the main community. But there's a concern that maybe at some stage it will be used for non-Orthodox worship. Is that going to be permissible? It comes to the conclusion there has to be a Tanai written in this sale that it's only going to be, the shul is only going to be used by Orthodox congregations. Non-Orthodox congregations can't use that shul. One of the reasons why I brought it was because, very famously in the, I guess it was the 1960s, the St. John's Wood Shul was sold, the old St. John's Wood Shul was sold, to the new emerging, to Louis Jacobs' congregation. So this is almost...
St. John's Wood Road.
If that's where it is. The old St. John's Wood Shul was sold. In any event, that was actually sold to a third party. The halachic way to deal with it is to sell it to somebody else, and then they can sell it on to whoever they want. But in part, this is sort of a parallel sort of question. Number four is very, very important. The question of whether or not people who are not Shabbat observant can be included in a minyan. We touched on this to some degree last week with Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the question of his non-observant moel. And his argument there was that if you haven't got 10 frum people seeing him being Mechal al Shabbat, then he hasn't got the dinner for Mechal al Shabbat for Farhesia. I suppose, 100 years later, the Malami Lahoyal is dealing with this question again, as I say, in a different social, religious, halachic context, where Rabbi Akiva Eiger was Rav. It was an anomaly to have somebody who wasn't Shomesh Shabbat, at least so it seems. That's where, by the time Malami Lahoyal came around, most people weren't Shomesh Shabbat. And that changes the landscape very significantly. So, Sheila, B'minyan Shelanu, Yesh Echad Oshnayim, this is already good, a couple of people who aren't Shomesh Shabbat, Shemechalim Shabbat Faresia. Now, part of the problem is, lo levad bimlachtam, not just by keeping their businesses open. Ki gamos im mugmar, they also smoke on Shabbat. Va'afil kiddush v'havdala inam osim, they don't even make kiddush and havdala. Ishar l'tzar fam l'minyan. So can you include them in a minyan? So there's lots of subtext, I think, reading between the lines, even in the question here, before we get to the answer. Since the subtext is, we're talking here at one or two people, it's not necessarily talking about an entire community, which is Mechal al Shabbat. But as I pointed out, last week, you'll have provincial communities, all around the world where, there's nobody from there, and they'll all, lend a hand in trying to make up a minyan, but none of them are actually from. He's stressing the point that they're smoking. It's not just they're keeping their businesses open. I think he thinks that if a person keeps his business open, you can argue that perhaps they're doing it because they feel they're anus. They can feel, how can I make a living with it if I don't have my business open on Shabbat? They're not halakhically justified, but it will change our perception of the type of chilul Shabbat they have, as opposed to somebody who smokes on Shabbat, which shows that he's got a total disregard for Shabbat. I had a great-grandfather who was knocked down by a horse while he was walking to shul, while he was walking to work on Shabbat morning. He was an immigrant. He believed that he needed to work on Shabbat, but he wouldn't travel to work on Shabbat. That's not Shmirat Shabbat, but it's a minor in some sense. It's recognizing the status of Shabbat as opposed to a person who smokes on Shabbat, which shows total disregard for Shabbat. He also makes the observation of Afil Kiddush v'Havdala in Amosim. What's that? Why is that relevant? I think he's thinking there of a tshuva of the Binyan Sion Reb Yaakov Etlinger, who... again, it was a generation before him, but part of that same group of German rabbonim, who said that a person who makes kiddush on Shabbat has not got the din of Mechalel Shabbat Kfar Hesia. Says, what's the, Rabbi Yaakov Eklinger says, what's the whole issue of being Mechalel Shabbat Kfar Hesia? Why is that a problem? As a person who's Mechalel Shabbat Kfar Hesia, it shows they don't believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. They don't believe in his power in that way. Person says, Kiddush, Vayechuna Shamayim V'aretz V'chol Tzva'am, Baruch Ata Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbat. Okay, they don't accept that God wants them to stay at home on Shabbat. But they recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, created the world. And therefore, he says that they wouldn't have the din of being Mechalel Shabbat Kfar Hesia. So let's see what his answer is. Yeah, it's you're right. It's not ignoring Shabbat. It's not observing Shabbat, but it's not ignoring Shabbat. Tshuva, HaPrima Gadim Simon Nun Hei Be'eshel Avram. So he's quoting the Prima Gadim. Katav to Mechalel Shabbat Faresia Ein Tzarfin Leminyan. So he's telling us where we get it from. It's a Prima Gadim who tells us person who's Mechalel Shabbat Faresia can't be included in a minyan. And he says, even though the Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that no, so long as a person hasn't been put into Cheirem, they can, even whatever their sin is, they can be included. He says he never doesn't actually say that you can include a Mechalel Shabbat. He quotes the Meshiv Davar, also the Netziv, who says that it is prohibited. Then he quotes the Magin Avraham, who says a person who is Rasha Bafar Hesia, publicly wicked, you can't include him in a Mezuman, etc. So those are the grounds to be strict and say they can't. That's the background, if you like. Raiti, I'm about five lines down. Raiti b'shut Rashban Simon Tzadik Shehevi b'shem shut Doresh Letzion. So it's quoting now some other authorities. Dezer davka b'muma lahachis. This is only talking about if the person is muma lahachis. That means they're breaking Shabbat or they're doing the Aveira to anger Hakadosh Baruch Hu. V'yamenu einosin lahachis. Nowadays, people don't do Aveirot to anger Hakadosh Baruch Hu. They do it because they don't really care enough not to do the Aveira. So that's a point that he discusses a little bit, and that's one consideration that he includes in the equation. And then he goes on to quote a tshuva from Reb Chaim Svi Mannheimer, who quotes the Mari Asad, Shemachalele Shabbatot Bismanenu, that contemporary Sabbath desecrators, Kolzman Sheloha Idu Alehem Bifnehem Bifneha Beitin Shelechilulu Bifne Yuzmi Israel. So long as there's not been testimony in a Beit Din that they were Mechalel Shabbat in the presence of 10 Jews, Enos Ribyai Bubagaam, then we don't say that they can't touch Shor, or if they touch wine, we don't say you can't drink it. Sheish Haba Achronim Sovereign, because there are many Achronim who hold, this notion that a person who desecrates Shabbat is as if they desecrated the whole Torah, which is a notion that comes up in Shulchan Aruch. It's the Prima Gadim who adds they can't be included in a minyan. The Shulchan Aruch tells us they've got the din of Mumma L'chol HaTorah, who rak mid Rabbanan, that's only mid Rabbanan and not mid Oraita. And therefore there's room to say that nowadays they haven't got that din. Hayotzei michol hanal, so it seems from what we said, shal pi din mechalel Shabbat b'faresia ein mitzarif leminyan, that according to the strict letter of the law, you can't include a mechalel Shabbat in a minyan. Ach bizman hazeh noagin lahakel, af be'eretz ungarin, so nowadays we make all, even in Hungary, because she came there as Ashkenaz, and certainly in Germany, where it's much worse, we tend to be Mekel. And then he says that he remembers once upon a time, there was an Avel who used to have his shop open on Shabbat, and he came to the Adas Yisrael, and he wanted to be the Baal Tefillah, and he got ready to act as Baal Tefillah, and the Gabbai was a person with good people skills, and he managed to dissuade him from taking the Amud. So the fellow went to a different shul, he went to the shul of the Chevras HaShas, and the Gabbai there, who was also good for a man, let him take the Amud, Amud, and Reb David Tzvi says so. Ask the Gabbai why he didn't stop him, and he says because this is the minhag where we are that we don't stop people, and he quotes again the Binyan Sion, skipping a few lines. Shekatav shem chalei Shabbat bizmanu nechshavim ketinok shenishba levein hanochrim. Nowadays, a person who's Mechalel Shabbat has got a din of Tinoch Shenishba. Tinoch Shenishba, in the classic sense, that's in the Gemara, that's talking about a child that was kidnapped as a baby, brought up amongst non-Jews, and breaks the mitzvot in the Torah, because nobody ever told him about the mitzvot in the Torah. So you can't hold that he's going to be Chayv. You can't give him the din of being Mumah L'chola Torah Kula. We assume that he'd like to keep Torah if he knew about it, but he doesn't know about it. So nowadays, we regard everybody like that. Because you haven't had a good Jewish education. So, okay, fine, you've heard of Shabbat, and some very frum people don't go to work on Shabbat. But everybody else is regarded as Tinoch Shenishba. Mipnei Sha'avonotenu HaRabim, Rav Yisrael Baratzenu Mechalei Shabbatein. Where we live, that's what he was saying, and it's true about us as well. Most Jews are Mechalel Shabbat. They're not denying the foundations of Jewish belief. It's just that's the realities. And then he goes on, so yeah, it's even worse in America. And he says, you know what, it would be best if you could have a frum person should always try and daven in a shul where the minyan is Shomrei Shabbat, but we're not going to make a big deal about it, and such people can be included in a minyan. So this is a very important tshuva in the contemporary scene, and much of what he's writing rings abundantly true today. That's I think your average non-observant United Synagogue member who comes to shul sometimes, whatever. They simply, you can be a good Jew, even though you don't keep Shabbat. They don't appreciate the halachic religious importance of keeping Shabbat. It's not a statement of rebellion against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore certainly Reb David Tzvi Hoffman felt that there was room to be lenient. A very important tshuva, which isn't relevant now, but was relevant 70 years ago, and relevant in America in the 1960s, should frum Jews try to dodge the draft? That doesn't mean to say keep the door closed when it's windy out. That makes the observation that, of course, you know, there's no such thing as being a frum Jew in the army. And in Ashkenaz they were being taken into the army. There was compulsory conscription. In Eastern Europe there was compulsory conscription. In this country there was conscription in the war and after the war. And should a frum Jew try and get a patur from it and not be part of that? Bearing in mind, you're inevitably going to have to be Mechalel Shabbat if you're in the army. In the first paragraph, he tells us what the question is. His introduction in the second paragraph to the answer is also telling. Tshuva she'ela gedola sha'alta. You've asked a good question. He tzricha iyun rav. Need to address it very carefully. Kedei lahashiv alehal pidina deshasu poskim l'chud. One has to answer it only considering Shas and Poskim. That's our sole guidelines. V'lo al pi netiyat libeinu levada, not just according to what we think is right. V'al kein amarti techila, therefore I said first of all, lo eilech lemakom asher libi chafetz. I'm not going to try and look for an answer that supports what I believe in. I'm going to learn through Shas and Poskim and then come to a conclusion. So his halachic methodology is interesting. We'll look just at the first paragraph and then skip a little bit. This is a famous sugi in the first parak of Masechet Shabbat. Tanu Rabbanan, ein mafligim b'sfina pachot migimul yamin kodem l'Shabbat. You're not allowed to go on a sea journey on a ship if it's if the sailors are Jewish within 3 days of Shabbat. By Medjavari Mamurim, what context are we talking about? Nidvah Harashut. That's if it's you're just going on a cruise. Yeah, it's a big issue if you've got a going on an Israeli cruise line. You want to go on a Mediterranean cruise with Zim ship lines sailing from Tel Aviv. You can't go if the ship sets off on a Thursday or a Friday, and according to some poskim, even on a Wednesday. But if you're going for a mitzvah purpose, so then it would be permissible. You make an arrangement with the sailors. They should cast anchor for Shabbat. And they don't, and fine. So then you're going to have to lend a hand and be mechalel Shabbat. Okay, fine. So the point is, making that, and it goes through the Rishonim. The point is, you're not allowed to go on a start off on in the run up to Shabbat to do something which you know is going to lead to Chilul Shabbat. Then there's a discussion in the Rishonim and the Achronim. Are you allowed to do it Lidvah HaRashut even at the beginning of the week? So can you go on a Monday? You decide you want to sail single-handedly around the world, right? So you're going to have to be Mechalel Shabbat. Are you allowed to go out on a Monday, get into your boat, set off from Folkestone, and sail around the world? So according to most poskim, you are. You couldn't set out on a Thursday or Friday. We'd recommend not to do it on a Wednesday either, even though inevitably you're going to be Mechalel Shabbat. If it's the Dvar Mitzvah, so then you can go even later in the week, even though you're going to be Mechalel Shabbat, because you're not breaking Shabbat at this point in time. Now skip to that's his halakhic consideration. You can see how this is going to be relevant here. So the question is, are you allowed to put yourself into this situation where you have to go, where you're going to have to be Mechalel Shabbat? If you're in that situation, you can definitely be Mechalel Shabbat. But can you put yourself into that situation? So is joining the Kaiser's army, is that the equivalent to going on a cruise? Or is it the equivalent to going on a mitzvah? Right? Well, I don't know if it's a mitzvah to be in the Kaiser's army, but I can't imagine it's anything like going on a cruise either. So in a halakhic sense, where's it for? So let's deal with our question. Says the notion that you shouldn't find some excuse to get, even if it's a legal excuse, to get out of going into the army. Not to do that is even more than a dvar mitzvah. It's more important than a dvar mitzvah. If he gets known that Orthodox Jews aren't going into the army because they don't want to be Mechalel Shabbat, that will cause a terrible Chilul Hashem. And it will cause terrible problems for the Jewish community. Our enemies will say Jews aren't patriotic, Jews aren't following the law of the land. If you sign up, go to the conscription office on a Monday, Sunday, Monday or Tuesday, then according to most poskim, you're not doing anything wrong. Even if you're going to have to be Mechalel Shabbat, then who are selling Dvar Mitzvah, you're doing it for a mitzvah, to save Jewish life. Or the Shah Mitzvah Mutar Filib Erev Shabbat Leilech Ba'atzmot Tzvah HaMilchama. You can go and sign up to the army. Im Ken Kal V'Chomer Hu, Im Hu Eino Holech Ba'atzmot, Rak Shenil Kachal Pi Dinat U'Malchuta. So certainly, if you're conscripted, Shebevadai She'inu Muchiyav L'Havriach Et Tzatzmot Mizeh, you certainly don't have to try and get out of it. Af Shebevadai Yav Olidei Chilul Shabbat, even though you're definitely going to be Mechalel Shabbat. Even though by doing this, you're going to because by not signing up, there are going to be all sorts of problems that you cause. This is a stronger case to compel it than Dvar Mitzvah. This is very, Baruch Hashem, in the current current climate, it's not relevant. But in times of war, this is a very relevant question. Many Frum Jews did sign up, many didn't. I'm sure there are chiluke deot about it. But this is, an important starting point for us. If I'm not mistaken, I think still, that's in America, the various denominations are all called on, the various Jewish denominations are all called on to provide Jewish chaplains for the US forces, and YU provides a number of chaplains. And I guess, if you're, put on, the person might say, listen, I'm not going to accept being a chaplain to the US forces, because, when they go to Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it is, you find yourself on a ship in a conflict area, you've got to be Mechalel Shabbat. That's, we see, there's room to allow it, and perhaps even to encourage it in certainly in some communal sense.
Someone wrote the minimum to be able to, if you conscript it, at least in Europe with the army, the minimum you need to do just to maintain some form of
Yiddishkeit. That's the Chafetz Chaim certainly wrote a sefer for soldiers in the army, I think called Machane Yisrael. Machane Yisrael? That's addressing that issue. That's some of the Gedolim of the last century were in the Russian army.
Speaking about cruises, years ago.
I don't want to get distracted by cruises. I'm only interested in soldiers at the moment.
All right.
So part of that question. Okay, that's. I just want to try and stay logged in to these questions. We'll just touch on the last few questions, but they're all very important. Number seven: can one swear in court bareheaded? This is a very important tshuva, not just because of what he says, but what happened to it. The Shailot and Tshuvot of Reb David Zvi Hoffman were published in his lifetime. And some of them just posthumously. And then subsequently they were reprinted. They weren't properly reprinted. They were just sort of photocopied, photographs, as a lot of the Sfarim were, for about 100 and something years. Well, I suppose 80 years. Simon Nun Vav in Yoredeya, there was a blank space in the book. The person publishing it decided, Reb David Zvi Hoffman was a wonderful Talmid Chacham, and it's so important for us to know his Torah, but we can't let him say such things like this, and we are censoring him. And it was taken out. Now, why was it taken out? It was taken out, he discussed the question, can you, you got to swear on oath in court, that's using Shem Shamayim, that's on a Bible, so can you do it without a kippah? So he discusses the the Hungarian Rabbonim, he says, are very, very strict on wearing a Gilu HaRosh, wearing a kippah all the time. He says the Gra says that it's only Midat Chasidut to wear a kippah, even when you're davening. Others say that if you make it a principle to take off your kippah, inside a formal building, then it becomes asur midoraita, because that's chukat hagoy. And if you look about 6, 7, 8 lines down, it says hinei b'kuf kuf yureim de Frankfurt de Main. So in the Adas Yureim, Frankfurt, b'veit hachinuch shenich yasein me'agon Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, that's how. Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's school. Shani hayiti more sham beit shanim v'chetzi. I taught there for 2.5 years. For secular studies, they sit there bareheaded. I should maybe say it more quietly. That's it's only when they're learning Torah they cover their heads. That's in Hamburg as well. This is all under his authority. So when I showed up as a new teacher in his school with my hat firmly fixed on my head, Amarli, he said to me, Shekanu derech eretz lahasirakov amel harosh. He said to me, young man, learn some manners and take your hat off your head. Kishabai nal adam chashuv, when you come to somebody important. Vula yireh mora acher. Another teacher will see. Yes, beit hachinuch sham gam harbe morim einam yehudim, because there are lots of non-Jewish teachers there. Shani eni masir akova mel harosh. They'll see I'm not taking my hat off. Lifnei rosh beit hachinuch, director, be in the presence of the head teacher. Hayam achashe sekilu ani mevazel to. It would look like I was insulting him. So he's saying this isn't chukat agoy. So anyhow, his conclusion is, ideally you should cover your head in court, but if you can't, then you can swear even without covering your head. But you can see why they wanted to suppress this. I don't believe in suppression of this. So if you're having the Tshuvot of Reb David Tzvi Hoffman, you print them in their entirety. In the new edition brought out about 5-6 years ago, it was included that you want his Torah included in its entirety. Now, if you don't want his Torah, then don't have it. It's a bit like when Art Scroll, you know, Art Scroll Chumash, you know, quote, they never say anything of their own. Everything is says exactly who said it, except there's one piece which is lifted word for word from Nechama Leibovitz, from the English translation of Nechama Leibovitz, mamish word for word, and it's the only thing in the volume which doesn't say who said it. That's you want to say Torah, then say where it came from. The other things like that are done as well, but now's not the time. Interesting question with regard to Chukat Agoy, the question of can you put flowers on a grave, and the parameters of Chukat Agoy. What that question reflects is that there are a number of tshuvot written by the German poskim on that subject, and there's a certain shift as time went on. As the battle lines between Orthodox and Reform shifted, this was at the outset a very big question. That's because it was any change, and eventually it became flowers on graves are the least of the problems that we're dealing with, and we can live with them, as it were. The final question, which again it's gone 10, so we won't go through it inside. Again, question that comes up all the time. You've got a Kohen who's married to a non-Jewish woman, wants to convert her and then marry her. The problem is that Kohen is not allowed to marry a Gioret. So it's all very well, you can convert her, but then it's not going to solve anybody's problems. And we'll just look, we won't look at it inside, but he addresses the question. He says, you know, what's worse, for this Kohen to be married to a Gioret or to a non-Jewish woman? They're not going to split up. So, is it what's worse? It's definitely worse to be married to a non-Jewish woman than it is to a Gioret. You can argue, he takes the attitude, he cites the Maharam Shik, who says that to marry out is an Issa-Doraita. Not everybody holds that. So if you hold that marrying out is only an Issa-Dorabanan, then it's actually going to be worse for a Kohen to marry a Gioret. But if you take the Maharam Shik's approach, that it's an Isidore writer which is Chayav Karet, so then that's going to be worse because Kohen marrying Yoret is only an Issa Lav. So he says that would seem, fine, convert her and let them get married and you're saving him from an Issa. But then he discusses various other considerations within that. He said, first of all, there's a question, do we say Chatei Kedesha Yizke Chavercha? Now, you should do an Issa so that somebody else will benefit from it. And he's also got the big question here. He says, hold on a minute. If a person converts and says, I'm converting, but I don't accept all the mitzvot of the Torah, then that's not a valid conversion. You have to You have to have full Kabbalat HaMitzvot. Person said, you know, this is a question that comes up all the time. I'd like to become Jewish, so I'm not going to keep Shabbat or Kashrut. That's, then it's an invalid conversion. So what are you going to do here? That's, you've got a Gioret convert. So, you know, this is, I think this was part of the JFS case a couple of years ago. But one of the Israeli converts, if I'm not mistaken, was married to a Gioret. And so therefore, sorry, not one of the Israeli converts was married to a Kohen. And therefore, the claim was that this is proof that, you know, she never converted wholeheartedly. Because you can't, she no, she couldn't marry a Kohen. And therefore, she was accepting everything except one mitzvah. And that's not acceptable. But he makes a different suggestion. And he says... it's the fourth line down of the big paragraph. If she says explicitly, yeah, I want to become Jewish, but I'm not going to accept that mitzvah, then she can't be Jewish. She's not spelling it out that she's not going to accept that mitzvah. Even though we know that she'll get married to him, so because... it's going to be worse for him to stay married to a non-Jewish woman than a Jewish woman, then we'll accept the conversion. He makes a couple of other relevant observations. He says that already in the question, it says that the case was a very sensitive case. It was an intermarried couple. They had a baby that had Brit Mila and everything. The baby died, and then she felt that she believed the baby was Jewish, which of course the baby wasn't Jewish, and she felt terrible that, oh, you know, now the baby's, you know, Jewish, and she's not Jewish, and when she goes to heaven or hell or wherever she goes to, she won't be together with her baby, she needs to convert. And here she had some mental illnesses. There was a concern that if they didn't convert her, then she would, you know, then she would go insane. And he says you've got a consideration of Chilul Hashem there as well, so that needs to be factored in. But he goes on to say that you can't be Masada Kiddushin for them. You know, they'll have to work that out. They'll have to find you can't have an Orthodox rabbi Masada Kiddushin for them. Interesting. I don't think we paskin like this in a contemporary. That's in a contemporary context, but certainly as an approach. Again, this might have been, you know, at a different time. You know, these are Maisim Shebachol Yom. You know, the Batei Din get people coming for conversion, carding with their non-Jewish girlfriends. It's happening all the time. I suspect this at that time it was a much more much rarer occurrence. Anyhow, Ad Kan with Malamid Lahoil. Next week, Ve'ezrat Hashem, we'll be looking at Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who also...